Welcome to Outbeat Collage Out in the Arts. I'm Gary Carnevale. Thank you for joining us this evening. Tonight we'll be joined by Jesus Conchola Sanchez, who is here to talk about his new children's book, Pepito Has a Doll. Later we'll chat with Brandon Moore, the director of Dennis, the Man Who Legalized Cannabis, which will be screened as part of San Francisco Indie Fest. And after that, we'll speak with Dennis Perrone's partner, John Entwistle Jr. But first up, Outbeat Radio News with Greg Moralia.
This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio News for the week of January 17th, 2021. Mark Hutt, a self-proclaimed conspiracy theorist and creator of the LGBT Trump social pages, was present at the attack on the U.S. Capitol that left five people dead. Hutt is a Rochester, New York native and was arrested, not once, but twice, for defacing the Black Lives Matter mural in New York City last summer. Charges are currently pending against him, and he pledged through his Facebook page to see Mayor Bill de Blasio in court. Hutt used his Facebook page, LGBT Trump, Gays for Trump, which has over 86,000 followers, to promote conspiracy theories and for his GoFundMe fundraiser, including one for traveling expenses to the January 6th protest. The campaign is no longer online, but archived snapshots of the webpage show that it was organized in November by Peter Brown, who Hutt was engaged to as of 2019. The fund supposedly went toward transportation to and from the District of Columbia, in addition to expenses for hotel, local transportation, Uber, megaphones, and banners. It's not immediately clear exactly how much the campaign raised, but as of the last screen capture on the Internet Archive's Wayback Machine, the GoFundMe had garnered at least $365 from 12 different donors. And a gay California man who also rioted at the Capitol last week and who was all full of bravado about how he, quote, proudly took back our Capitol, end quote, is now afraid for his life. Christopher Drew is a gay stylist who participated in last week's riot that left five people dead. He's a hairdresser in Huntington Beach who is popular with the online right, in part due to his podcast. He goes by the name Adorable Deplorable. But it turns out that being a well-known participant in an attack on American democracy isn't all that it's cracked up to be. In an interview with the Orange County Register, Drew said that he was driving back to California and was receiving death threats the entire way from both opponents and supporters of Donald Trump. Drew said that in the riots, his loyalty to right-wing causes was questioned as Republicans accused left-wing activists of infiltrating their movement and engaging in their violence on the Capitol. Drew said that he's also worried about his business, Hair by Christopher Drew. The business's Yelp page has been flooded with negative reviews, many of them talking about his participation in the attempted coup. And the U.S. House of Representatives has approved gender-neutral language in its official House rules and established a permanent Office of Diversity and Inclusion. These measures were adopted as part of a package at the start of the 117th Congress. The changes mean that the rules document will use language such as parent, child, and sibling instead of mother, father, son, daughter, brother, and sister, and it will also replace chairman with chair. In addition to the provision on gender-neutral language, the rules will also promote inclusion through the Office of Diversity and Inclusion, which will facilitate a diverse workforce, and by mandating that standing committees address inequities relating to race, gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, and other characteristics. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia.
Jesus Conchola Sanchez is a Chicago-born actor and director who has just released his first children's book, Pepito Has a Doll. Welcome to Outbeat Collage, Jesus.
Thank you for having me, Gary. Really glad to be here with you.
Thanks. Tell us a bit about your personal life and professional background.
Yeah, I'm born and raised in Chicago. I'm currently based in Chicago, which is great to be back in my home city after living in New York City for quite some time. So glad to be back in the Midwest. But I have experience working as a writer and producer on television. And last year in 2019, I had my first film, Bittersweet Waters, my first feature-length film, produced and it premiered in Mexico and film festivals across the U.S. and across the globe. And that was a culmination of many years of work as a writer for other production companies, for theater in New York City, and also working as an actor to some extent, and being able to kind of put all those skills into having my first feature-length film come together, which I shot in Mexico and premiered last year in 2019. Actually, now it's going to be 2 years now that we're in 2021. That kind of culminates my full experience as a writer, as a director, as an actor. But I really do see everything kind of from the lens as a writer. So for me, everything starts from the written word. And I'm so glad that I had the opportunity to have my first feature film completed, and it's currently available on streaming if you have Amazon Prime Channel Deku or through TLA Releasing. They're releasing it here in the United States. It's definitely available for folks to watch. And that has then led me to Pepito Has a Doll. It's been a dream of mine since I was a child to write my own children's book. And this was the opportunity to do it. I just felt like it was a natural, as I was doing pre-production for my next film, I just thought that was a good time. And I got to meet Armando, who's the illustrator in the project. And we just started to chat and spark, and the project kind of started to grow from that. But really, the movie kind of represents the culmination of all the work that I've been doing in the last 2 years. And now Pepito Has a Doll is a continuation of that work to continue to grow as a writer and as a creator and as a producer of stories.
Wow, wow. You're a renaissance man, Jesus. My goodness. That's terrific. That's terrific. I mean, I really want to chat about the book, of course. But let's go back to the film. How exciting that it premiered in film festivals. You know, given the kind of dicey year we had last year, but that it's available on Amazon at this point. Talk a bit about the subject matter of the film and what it meant to you to write it and film it and star in it.
Yeah, so Bittersweet Waters, it took me about a year to write the script, and it began from, so I knew that I wanted to shoot the film in the hometown of my father, which is in the central state of Mexico. The state is called Guanajuato. And it started off from the spark of my kind of imagination of, like, what would my life have been if I had grown up in this little small town that my father is from? You know, it's about 700 people or so. And what would it have been if I'd be the same person, like, a gay man growing up in this really small conservative town? And it kind of began from that. So the story really centers around how a young man growing in this small town, living this secret relationship with the man he loves, ultimately learns to love himself. And that's ultimately the journey that the character takes. And, you know, there's some conflict there with the mother figure and, of course, figuring out, does he stay with the man that he loves or does he stay true to himself? Because the man that he loves wants to, you know, have a more traditional role in his community and be married to a woman. And that's the basic arc of the story. And I got to shoot it, after writing it. It took me about another year, fully independent.
Wow.
You're a filmmaker as well, so you know the level of kind of work that it takes to, you know, just pre-produce, to write, to figure all the logistics out. It took me another year to kind of get the team together and get some funding together. And then we finally just did it. I just decided to go ahead and do it. I shot in Mexico for about 24 days straight. And it was a dream. It was wonderful. It really was such an amazing team that I was able to gather. The actors were fantastic. And now it's available for folks to stream if they choose to watch it. I would love for them to take a look. Bittersweet Waters in English and Spanish, Agua Agridulce. It is a Spanish language film. But it was important for me to kind of explore that, even though it started with like my imagination of what would my life have been if I'd, you know, grown up in this place. It's definitely like fictional, though with some tinges of like, you know, autobiographical moments. And my grandmother makes her acting debut in it. She does play my grandmother in it. And she, at that time, was in her late 80s. She just turned 92, so she makes her acting debut as, like, you know, an older person, which is wonderful. And
Oh, my goodness.
So happy to be able to work with her. But, you know, for any writer and filmmaker, anyone who's interested in making films, seeing your first film on the big screen with an audience is just a dream come true, and I had the opportunity to do that. So I'm really grateful for that, and it's been such a great journey, and it was a tough one as well, because sometimes it was like, oof, how am I going to feed the crew, you know?
Sure.
How am I going to make this happen? But we did. I did, and we did it in the team, and now we're working on the next one. The next one will be an English language one, and I'm hoping to shoot it in Chicago if all goes well. So, yeah, check it out, Bittersweet Waters.
Absolutely. Good plug. Perfect. I will watch it tonight when I get home. The film premiered at the Chicago LGBT Film Festival.
Yeah, in the United States, its world premiere was in Mexico City at the LGBT Film Fest there in Mexico City. And the first place, it was the first major city to run it was Chicago, which was wonderful, to have it run here. Because most of my family lives in the Chicago area, so I was able to share it with them on the big screen. And you know, really, the LGBT Film Festival here in the city is wonderful, and they always have such a great selection of films that they curate. And I was just so glad to be a part of it, especially there's just a special kind of connection when you kind of bring something that you create home, you know, and then when you have your own family in the audience, it was just a really special moment. To have it be part of Reeling Film Festival.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. I mean, I remember the really early days of the LGBT Film Festival. I don't think it was called Reeling back then, but, you know, we're talking about the Jurassic period. So, because I went to Columbia College, and I studied film at Columbia College, which you're probably familiar with, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
So where were you educated? Where did you learn your trade?
So for undergrad, I went to Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio. This really awesome kind of hippie school that really allows you to grow and kind of do your own thing and really learn by doing. So I was really appreciated. That's actually the first place where I had I wrote my first play, and I had it produced, like, you know, I did it all on my own, and I think it was the kind of environment that allowed you to do that. So I feel I'm really grateful because it really allowed me to begin to kind of professionalize my writing in that way, in the sense of like understanding structure, understanding timing, understanding kind of all the components that go into like producing your own work as an independent artist. So Antioch College, and then from there I went to grad school in New York City, and I had most of my like adult years in New York City, where I went to acting school, and then I started writing plays at the same time. Most of my writing, I've just been learning by doing. I didn't necessarily study writing, creative writing, or playwriting in any of my formal education, but it's always something that has been within me, and it's been a passion of mine. And I've been working at it. So here we are now, you know, fully, you know, exploring all the possibilities that the written word has for my creative expression, you know?
Nice, nice. So back to the book. What prompted you to write Pepito?
Yeah, Pepito Has a Doll started with just the memory of me growing up playing dolls. And I loved children's books growing up, but, you know, I grew up with a kind of a conservative Mexican family that only kind of exposed me to, like, children's Bible stories, and I was allowed to read stuff like Curious George, you know, stuff with animals and things like that. But I grew up playing with dolls, and I remember that my grandmother was the only one who kind of allowed me to play freely with the dolls. Mm. There were a number of my family members who actively, you know, did not want me to play with dolls because I was a boy and would, like, take them away or hide them from me or, like, scold me. And, of course, being a young child of, like, 6, 7, you just don't, you know, you don't understand the prejudice that's coming at you from an adult, you know?
Right, right.
I wanted to, as an adult, I'm still fascinated by children's books, stories, the visual of them, and the storytelling of them geared towards children. And for me, I'm still entertained by reading those. And as a grown-up, now being, like, you know, fully out gay man, I've always been so interested in kind of the journey of the LGBT children's book history, you know?
Right.
And one of the books that really inspired me when I discovered it, as I was reading different kind of books that touch on diversity, was William's Doll, which was a book that came out in 1972, like, you know, before my time. And I was just like, whoa, this book about a boy and his doll came out. It's written by Charlotte Salatov, she's a renowned children's book writer who's no longer with us, but she's, like, really prolific, has many, many books. But William's Doll is one of them. And this came out in 1972, and it's about a boy and his doll, but the book kind of gears more of, like, William wanting to be a father or a dad. Doesn't really explore kind of, like, gender norms or sexuality, really, or touches on it. It's just more of, like, straight up, like, he wants to be a father and boys should play with dolls because, you know, it allows them to be better dads kind of message. But it was such a wonderful story, and I was, like, so inspired by it. And also just the time, right? Just imagine, like, whoa, 1972, like, how many books were tackling any kind of, like, diversity on gender norms, you know, for boys and how they play. So that kind of sparked with me and the idea of my own experience growing up playing with dolls. And then Pepito started to formulate, you know, Pepito has a doll, the story started to come together. And I decided to partner with an artist that I trust and know, and I met Armando, who's the illustrator. Armando Minjares Monarres, who's the illustrator of Pepito Has a Doll. We had met, I was doing some work with undocumented immigrants in Kansas, and he was really active in that community. He's an artist that does a lot of murals in Kansas and is really active in, like, community art projects. He now has his own a ceramic studio as well. So he's been, like, really active in different forms of, like, art, but also really active in, like, community issues such as immigration. And at that time, I was doing some work with undocumented immigrants, and we got to meet, and then I found out that he was an artist. And then it all just kind of came together because I had the idea of the story, and then I talked to him about it, and then we just started workshopping it. And it took us about a year or so of workshopping it back and forth, like off and on. And then I did the draft, he did some illustrations, and we, like, went back and forth on talking about, like, you know, different colors and forms and the look and the feel and what scenes and all of that. And here we are now, going to come out January 20th, and we're really excited to share our baby with the world. But that's how it sparked. It sparked from that memory of mine playing with my dolls and some of my family members taking them away from me. And then as an adult, being exposed to the really rich kind of history of a children's book touching on diversity, and specifically William's Doll kind of sparking that of, like, oh, I should share that story in this format because it's just a perfect visual format, and the story itself lends itself well to it. And why not, right? I have the story. Why not do it? So that's how it all started, and how we came to this point of now having an actual book that we can share with folks.
I seriously can't wait to order about 5 copies, which I'll be doing soon. The illustrations are beautiful, and the story is so touching. It just congratulations to you both.
Thank you.
So who would you say is your target audience for the book?
So definitely, you know, I love for children to be exposed to the story. But of course, children are exposed to stories usually through adults, right, that buy them the
right.
stories or, you know, the books that they have. So definitely parents who want to read these stories to their children, but also teachers who are also really influential on the kind of stories that are shared with children. So I think those are folks that I'm consistently thinking about, but also, you know, communities that are growing up bilingual, Spanish and English. I think the reality of our world is that there are many families that are multilingual. And I grew up in a household, the book is bilingual, Spanish, English, and I grew up in a household that, you know, grew up with both languages consistently, you know, and I think all those things like come into play as I develop the story to make it accessible to those folks, but it's really a universal kind of story. And of course, you know, for those boys that played with dolls when they were little, of course, you know, there's so many of us that did that, you know, and I think it's such a great way to share those experiences. And for anyone who identifies as a man who grew up, you know, as a boy playing with dolls, to be able to share that with children is, I think, a positive thing. Because there's still so many communities that feel the way some of my family members felt. You know, even today, we're in 2021, but there's still so many communities within the United States, outside of the United States, that do feel that, you know, boys should not play with what is considered feminine toys, right? So I think it's still an important message for us to carry and to share and to be able to talk with children about, like, playing freely without judgment and without prejudice.
That's right. And you know, I've interviewed a few children's books authors and other sort of activists around the subject of queer books, getting queer books in the hands of young people. And one author suggested, you know, when you find a book you love, and if you're able to, buy several copies and approach your local school librarians or your local library, you know, libraries, and say, I think this is a wonderful book. And, you know, as a member of this community, you know, I'm asking that you get it on your shelves and get it out to young people.
Yeah, that's definitely such a great idea. And actually, someone just did that. And I got a message from a school teacher in Austin, the librarian actually in this elementary school, which happens to be a bilingual school.
Mm-hmm.
And they want me to do a reading with their student body. So it works. It definitely works when a member of the community takes something like a children's book to like their local school library and say, hey, I think this project, this book, this story is important for our community. We should have it in the shelves, you know. So absolutely, I think that works for sure.
Nice. Did you need to find a publisher, or did you publish it yourself?
No, so it took you know, we submitted to a number of possibilities, but ultimately I just decided, let's just do it. And we published independently, yep.
Wow, that's amazing. Good for you. When it comes to the film industry and it comes to publishing, I mean, creative folks, artists have so many more options now. You know, you don't need to sell the rights away to your work. You can, you know, maintain control of those rights and exhibit it as you see fit.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm also like a little impatient with the process. I'm just going to do it. Like, this is my time frame and this is what I'm going to do it. So, you know, there are pros and cons to, you know, doing everything independently. Of course, when you have backing and you have financial support, there's that. But also having the creative control, just like what you're talking about, I think is so essential. And for me, it's so essential to have like full creative control and full creative say on how your work is represented, you know. So I fully embrace the independent artist category, you know, like,
right.
I feel like it's definitely a part of how I see things and how I just move forward and do what I feel is necessary to get my work out there.
That's terrific. So so how can folks go about ordering the book?
Yeah, so it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and a number of other online platforms, and folks can reach it that way. Check out, if you want to see like a full list, check out pepitohasadoll.com, and we'll have a full list there available. But starting January 20th, you can pre-order now as well for any upcoming birthdays or any kind of special events where you want to share this kind of story with people you love and care about.
That's perfect. Was the release date just coincidentally the inauguration date?
Yeah, that just kind of happened. Yeah. It was not intentional.
Okay, perfect. I have a few minutes left. You want to get all political on me and give us your, you know, from an artist's point of view, what's happening in this country?
You know, it's so wild. Honestly, I really feel at times really disheartened with what's going on, but at the same time, I feel there are opportunities for us to continue to share stories. And I think from my perspective, it's like this is the essential time for us to share our stories with each other so we can better understand where we're coming from and really listen to each other, because I think there's so many of us that are not necessarily listening to each other outside of whatever bubble is our bubble, you know? And I think artists, folks, creative folks have such a specific kind of role to be able to share diverse kinds of stories across platforms, across audiences, and I think that's what I want to do, and that's what I want to focus on, because as disheartened as we can be about all that's going on, I think we have to find an opportunity for growth and healing and change. And ultimately, I think that's what all of this represents. It's much needed change that I hope is good change, because change can also be negative, right? So, that's how I approach it. You know, I try to stay active and positive and contribute to my communities in a positive way and try to understand the folks that are around me and folks that aren't around me to be able to build something better for each other and folks that come after us.
Ah, that's beautifully expressed. Thank you. Thank you so much for that. Do you want to talk about the film that you're working on now?
Yeah, I send me all the good vibes, folks, to make sure that my second film makes it. I finished my script. It's titled Uptown Lovin', and I hope to shoot it maybe this year. We'll see. It depends, right? It's kind of all of these things are in flux because of all that's going on with the pandemic. But if all goes well, maybe this year, potentially next year at some point. But yeah, Uptown Loving is a story about these two men who are figuring out how to love each other in an urban environment and figuring out whether having a child makes sense for them in Chicago. So keep an eye out and send me the good vibes to make sure that it gets produced and that we have something to offer for as my second film and my first English language film, because the first one was in Spanish. So Uptown Loving. Keep an eye out.
There you go. Well, Jesus, thank you so much, and best of luck to you with the film, with Bitter Waters, and with of course with the book Pepito Has a Doll, where which you can order at pepitohasadoll.com, right?
Yeah, we have it listed there, and it'll link to all the platforms that where it's available for purchase. So check it out, pepitohasadoll.com.
Lovely. Jesus, thank you so much for joining us tonight, and best wishes for the new year.
Thank you, Gary. Take care. Have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to KRCB-FM Windsor. K215CQ Santa Rosa, a service of Northern California Public Media. Brandon Moore is an Oakland-based award-winning director, producer, and editor. His latest film, Dennis, the Man Who Legalized Cannabis, will be screened as part of San Francisco Indie Fest, which happens February 4th through 21st. Welcome to the show, Brandon.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tell us a bit about your background and your films.
I have been directing films for over 10 years, based here in the Bay Area, and I do everything from branded content, commercial, documentary. I'm kind of a little bit of everything, and but with an emphasis on storytelling, and whether that's short form or longer form, like this Dennis piece would be considered long form in my line of work, coming from commercial. So that runs about, 20 minutes. I'm used to 30 seconds here. The shortest attention spans these days.
So when did you first become aware of this important place in San Francisco queer history?
Actually, to sort of start from the beginning, I was working with a local company called PAX. They are a cannabis technology company. So what that means is that they don't produce any cannabis oil or extracts or anything like that. They simply make technology for their brand partners or extractors that are all in the legal cannabis realm to create and provide their products on. So they approached me 2 years ago with this incredible project. They said, we want to make a documentary film on this guy, Dennis Perrone. At the time, I had no idea who Dennis was, and I started down the research rabbit hole and really found that there was a lot of not too many people these days have heard of Dennis, but if you simply do a research a search on him, you'll discover there's actually a lot of press around Dennis, and that goes into one of the primary reasons of why he was so successful at changing the public's opinion about cannabis, especially cannabis as a medicine. At the time, he was a veteran, an out gay man. He came back from Vietnam, set up shop to open the first cannabis club ever in existence in the Castro, and just really stood by his beliefs as a cannabis as a medicine, and that later on down the road really transformed into being a very valuable resource during the AIDS epidemic, and it's just an incredible journey for one individual to have, and this really is a means, what was a means for PAX as a modern cannabis organization to look back at its roots, its history, and sort of pay homage to those that paved the way.
Mm. So when you went down that researching rabbit hole, what were you surprised to learn about Dennis or the subject matter?
I could have made a feature film about Dennis. I want to make a feature film about Dennis. He is super inspiring, fearless individual. No matter how much, force was met from authorities, from the local level all the way to the federal and state level, he never backed down. He stood his ground in what he believed is cannabis as medicine, and didn't let, anyone really prevent him from doing what he thought was his life's work, which was providing cannabis as medicine. And so Sorry, I lost track of the initial question.
What were you most surprised to learn about while doing your research? Right.
So many things. Dennis, first that he was a veteran, that was really interesting to me. He, he was a hippie through and through, and, you know, coming out of a terrible thing like the Vietnam War, I can only imagine what an experience like that can do to an individual. But he seems to come out of it with even more compassion than he did going in, and just dedicating his life. I'm trying to think of some like really fun like anecdotes. He was shot by in a raid, one of many raids. That's actually one Easter egg that I wasn't able to get to in the film due to timing limitations. He threw like a water jug at them, and this was like one of many raids, by the way. And so it was in the 70s, and I think it was on a local level. It wasn't a federal raid, and he basically was shot, and it did not bode well for the local police force, basically because Dennis was extremely smart and savvy when it came to optics of the situation. So he was really smart and able. He always had the best people in his corner, whether it was like a lawyer or, you know, and not in the slimy way. Like, these were all people that were patients of his, but also it's a community coming together and under like a similar belief and fighting for what they believe in. And so Dennis was just really able to, he was really, really good at getting people together and rallying for a central reason.
So, I mean, for me, this is as much an AIDS story as it is a cannabis activism story. Talk a bit about what motivated Dennis as far as it comes to cannabis as medicinal, for medicinal use.
Yeah. Well, funny thing is that Dennis believed that all cannabis use was medicinal, so if you were to say, like, now that it's legalized recreationally, he wouldn't say he would believe in recreational use, but in that, like, the people that are using it, if they want to consider that recreation, he would still say that they're using it for a specific reason, whether it's, you know, anxiety, like insomnia, or, you know, there's always like a deeper lying reason why people gravitate to use cannabis as a form of medicine, whether that sort of like is intrinsic to their initial reason to using it. I think he believed that it was really all medicinal at the base level.
Nice, nice. I mean, because talk about the sort of three, I think there were three different cannabis clubs that he opened and how they differed.
Yeah. So, okay. This is going to test my memory here. So there was the Island, which was sort of like a bar restaurant. Dennis was not a drinker at all. Like, he was very opposed to alcohol consumption. And he had – so this Island bar restaurant that was open I think right shortly after he moved to the Castro. And then there was this is gonna really test.
That's all right. I have let's see. I have the Big Top Pot Big Supermarket, right?
The Big Top came after the Island, I believe. That's sort of when it really started to take off. I only think these were open for only a few years each. Like, they had very short you know, all of his clubs had such short lives right. because of all the police intimidation. So, you know, by the time you're up and running and people know about it, the cops know about it also, and they're going to shut it down.
Right.
So he was constantly moving his clubs throughout the Castro, and then, you know, ultimately in the early 90s, like at the peak of the AIDS epidemic, he moved to this really giant, beautiful space on Market Street and was really able to start serving, you know, people on a scale and a higher capacity that enabled him to reach a lot of people, and then ultimately was able to bring the press in there, and that sort of became, I think, the most famous of the cannabis clubs, because it was the one that was, you know, on CNN and all over right. the news for a few years there.
Right, and then we got into Proposition 215, which passed in 1996.
Yeah. Yeah, Dennis was the co-author of Proposition 215, which initially, he never was a full-fledged politician. However, he did run for various offices over the years. I think he had ambitions to make change, and I think that's what he thought would be the right way to make change on, you know, the biggest scale possible. He was never elected into office. However, he had a lot of clout on a local level. And, you know, his relationship with Harvey Milk alone was, you know, something that detail that I wasn't able to get in the film was that whole relationship they had. I 20 minutes, I can only get into so much, and I wish I could have got, like, save that one for the possible feature later on.
Right, right. But,
he was very politically active in that he, before Prop 215 was drafted, he was responsible for pushing through Proposition P, which was sort of a local measure that decriminalized cannabis use, which this is all like crazy for the time.
Right, right.
Like, nowadays, you know, there's still states like considering to use it for medicine on a right, state level. Right, right. But this was big, and he wasn't alone in 215. He had a lot of incredible collaborators. One, Dale Gehringer, who's in the film from Cal Normal, he was a huge partner in that whole push, and still is, you know, with Cal Normal and fighting that fight
right.
on a federal level. And Proposition 215 was, I think, a huge... That really was the change, the tides changed after that, because when it got on the ballot, people didn't think it was, or before it got on the ballot, no one thought it was going to get on the ballot. Then it got on the ballot,
right, right.
And it passed. And I think it really was a testament to all the work that Dennis did changing the public's opinion by bringing the press into his cannabis clubs and showing that there's these people that look just like your grandma that are token up weed in the club, and that it completely changed people's opinion of, and they actually were able to entertain the idea of cannabis as medicine. So a lot of work, groundwork had to be laid before Proposition 215 became a reality and was even able to pass.
Right, right. And a lot of raids and a lot of arrests and a lot of probably cracked heads and yeah, let us not forget.
A lot of violence.
Right, right.
A lot of people's lives destroyed by the war on drugs. And just politicians and lawmakers that were just completely insensitive and averse to the idea that cannabis could be a medicine. And it takes a long time. We're still working on erasing all of that.
That stigma, and, that, right, right.
Yeah.
So what do you hope that the audience will take away from Dennis, the man who legalized cannabis?
I'm hoping that they can take away a sense of empowerment, in that we all, especially these days, have power as, you know, citizens of the United States, but also members of our own communities. I think what Dennis can teach us all is that we can make giant changes in the world by starting locally and working within your communities, and then eventually working your way up to bigger things. And so change starts small, and that if you believe in something, that you should pursue it, and that you have the power to make change. It's what makes this country awesome.
That's right. That's right. And it's an important story you tell, and we thank you for telling that story, and we thank you for joining us this evening, Brandon.
Thank you.
John Entwistle Jr. appears in the documentary and was Dennis Perone's partner, and we're going to have a little conversation with him now. Welcome to the show, John.
Glad to be here, Gary. Nice to be on the air here with you.
Talk a bit about your sort of background pre-Dennis.
I was an activist all the way going back. I've been a cannabis activist since I was a young man, since I was 17, 16 years old. My family tried to have me put in a mental institution for smoking pot. You see, and this is not, that's not an uncommon story. Back in the 1980s, that was very common for a lot of young people. And I fought it really hard. I said, no way. Hit the street and joined a radical group called the Yippies, who were fighting these laws in a big way. And they were doing smoke-ins, gathering thousands of people together and handing out marijuana. And the cops, of course, would try to stop them. But, you know, you can be pretty sneaky, and you got a lot of people. You have a little bit of power. And so we were organizing, and for a long time there, we would do demonstrations, for example, in front of the United Nations building, protesting the single convention treaty that makes marijuana illegal all over the planet. This thing goes very far. We would go and protest the president because he was supporting the war on drugs. That was Ronald Reagan back at the time, the ultimate drug warrior. And, you know, we would do smoke-ins in D.C. in front of the White House and all over the place. And that was where I met Dennis Perone. Dennis Perone was one of the few cannabis activists in this country back then. A lot of people were with the program. A lot of people went with the program. They said, well, if it's illegal, I'll just go underground and see if I can't make a few dollars selling it or growing it. You know, why fight it, right? Why not just take advantage of this opportunity? But some of us said, this is really important. This is bigger than just making a little bit of money. You can make money doing anything. But, you know, you can't be thrown out of your house for just anything. You can't lose your kids for just anything. You can't be fired for just anything. You get it? This is a special category of thing. And it's got to be, we got to address this. But very, very few people back in the United States back in the 1980s saw it that way. Dennis was one of the few. Dennis was a cannabis dealer from San Francisco, a gay man who was out there fighting with two flags, two banners. He'd go out all of this at the time. It was a new thing. It was a big thing. Gay people were just coming out of the closet. Gay people were just busting out into the streets. Gay bars weren't hiding anymore, and they weren't getting raided anymore. See, so you know, while we're fighting for gay liberation, at the same time, he was fighting and going around the country and speaking out as a marijuana smoker. So we flew a Dennis out to New York City several times to speak at our events, and that's where the friendship kind of started. We became dear friends back then.
So talk about the types of struggles, you know, legal and sort of personal, that you both faced because of your activism.
Okay, well, as I said, you know, each of us, I mean, he was radicalized in Vietnam. Dennis went to Vietnam, and they had him, you know, they tried to get him to carry a gun and shoot people. He wouldn't do that. He basically was fixing radios and working on airplanes for the Air Force. But, you know, he was, at one point, they put him down there literally sending bodies home to the United States. Where, you know, for a month, he was the guy helping load these caskets and load these dead infantrymen, young guys, you know, 20-year-old kids, 19-year-old kids, onto airplanes and send them back to their families in the United States. This changed his perspective for life. He ended up hitting the war more than you can imagine, okay, because you see America at its very, very worst. And so that's where Dennis came from. He came out of that saying that the key to America is sex and drugs. yeah, but he's right. You get it? It's a great line, but it's true. You know, sex and drugs are the key to our society, and it's the thing that we are the most hung up about. And we're so hung up, we're willing to kill people. You know? And that's terrible. So that's where he put his focus. He came back, he's going to follow Harvey Milk's example, come out of the closet as a gay man, you know, make that very clear to everyone that asks, so that you can say, here, Dennis, that's, when I'm thinking of gay people, that's Dennis. That's my friend Dennis, not just some anonymous person out there, but that's my friend. And then he came out and said, you know, the marijuana thing is really important. He's right. Marijuana has always been a peaceful drug. You get it? And we are an alcoholic society. You know, we're like the British or something, you know?
Right, right.
Drink is just disgusting. It's notorious. It's terrible. And it creates an account of violence that's just so extraordinary in our society. And so the idea is to fight that back, is to fight. Now, so with the Yuppies and through the creative protests of the 80s and the 90s, we did a lot of smoke-ins. We did a lot of gatherings, a lot of concerts, free concerts, outdoors. The idea was to bring people out, get them standing next to each other, get them communicating, get them talking, and then bring politicians, elected members of you know, the Board of Supervisors or the Assembly or the Senate or whatever, and give them an audience. So we bring thousands of people together and then bring, like, an assembly person or a supervisor, put them on stage, and they could speak about what they're doing to help us. And it really, you know, it mattered. You're starting at ground zero. You're starting at point zero. So you want to decrease the budget of the guys who are hunting you. You know what I mean?
Right,
you
right.
Decrease the sentences, okay? You want to stop the machine. And then, you know, so that's where it all started. That's what we were doing for the longest time. And it wasn't really working. You know, we were trying our hardest. But public opinion was still basically saying, you know, we can make all this money and we can still smoke. It's just underground and secret and, you know, why bother?
Right, right. What do you think Dennis would say about how far the movement has progressed?
Well, before we go there, let me just explain to you more. So the other side of the thing, aside from doing big events and stuff like that, which was an attempt at talking to the press, which was an attempt at publicity and an attempt at persuading society to take a different course, and it failed, as I mentioned. The other thing that we spent a lot of time and a lot of energy doing was fighting individual cases. Cases, case after case after case after case, people getting busted, and they're looking at going to jail. They're looking at penalties. You know, fines. They're looking at all kinds of problems. And so we would get in there and get them a lawyer, you know, show up at their hearings and, you know, bail them out, fight with them, you know, and try to give them ideas and better techniques and better tactics for fighting. So we had a long, long, you know, decades of basically a very difficult struggle that wasn't working. We were fighting for defendants, you know, who were basically getting charged and going to jail anyway, you know, less time if we were successful. And we were fighting, you know, politicians who were basically just ignoring us, saying later, tomorrow, mañana, sometime later we'll do that. You know, not important today. We'll do that later. This is more important today. So we did that for decades. And then the AIDS crisis came along. You see?
Right, right.
In the middle of the AIDS crisis.
Hey, hey, John, I have to stop you. I'm already running low on time. So
the AIDS crisis was the thing that changed everything.
Yeah.
And that's the point where Brian's movie jumps in, and so it gives you the rest of the story.
Right, great. All right, really, really quickly, what do you think Dennis would make of the movement?
He'd be very happy. I mean, you know, this is what we wanted to see. We wanted to see it progress. We wanted to see it change. We wanted to see this happen. But he would also be restless, and he would be still agitating for even more change.
That's fabulous. John, I'm sorry we're short of time tonight, but we will have you back, and we'll continue this interview over at gaysonoma.com.
I can't wait, Gary. It's a great talking to you, and thank you for getting us on the air.
Of course. Thank you so much, John, and best wishes to you, and keep up the good fight.
Thank you, Gary. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. I want to thank all of my guests this evening, Jesus Conchola Sanchez, Brandon Moore, and John Entwistle Jr., and we thank you for listening this fine evening. Please listen to Outbeat Radio every Sunday evening at 8 p.m. right here on KRCB. Next week, Greg Moralia returns with Outbeat News in Depth. I'll be back in February with my friend and our guest, Jennifer Larson, who is here to speak about her first gay romance. Have a great evening. Hope you will be able to watch the inauguration, kind of an important day for our community. Thanks again for listening, and good night.